Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Esprit Devora, and Esprit is a podcaster. She's the host of the LA Tech Startups podcast and the Women in Tech podcast. She was named as one of the top 30 women in tech to follow by Inc. magazine, and she was also the face of Clubhouse. This was a really interesting conversation, and it starts off with Esprit going on a 3-minute talk about hustle culture. And we were just chatting before the show was beginning, and then she goes off on this rant, and I wanted to include it because I think it's important, and it gives way to how the conversation unfolded. I really enjoyed this episode. I think you will as well. If you do, or you have any thoughts or feedback about the episode, let me know on Twitter at HeyDannyMiranda. I appreciate all your feedback, and I'm so grateful when someone messages me out of the blue and says, hey, I listened to this podcast, I loved it, or I didn't. Let me know what you think. It really means the world to me. Anyway, that is all from me. I hope you guys enjoy this episode with Esprit Devora.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
We live in a culture where this hustle culture is promoted. And I lived most of my entrepreneurial career that way. No sleep, sacrifice, eat ramen. It's like, once you have like breakups and divorces and people who lose their kids and lose everything and mortgage their house and are sleep deprived, they're the champions. I'm like, no, that's false. And it took me in my entire career to recognize that that's just, I mean, maybe that's how you make the most money ever. I don't think so. I just don't think that's a healthy way to promote anything. And so I think a lot of people promote this. Like I was listening to somebody this week who I thought was like a great founder. And then somebody said in the interview, how many hours do you sleep? And they're like, oh, only 4 hours. I was like, ugh. Like, it makes me lose all respect. Like, as though that's a good thing, you know? It's just not Do you know, for our brain, there's like, okay, this is really interesting. I was watching a brain doctor this week because I was, and said the most interesting statement. He said he became really passionate about the brain because he found it to be crazy that when you have your heart worked on, you have your heart examined. When you have XYZ worked on before you get medicine, before you have surgery, you have that examined. So people actually see what's going on. But the brain, no one does a brain scan before deciding what's wrong with you. They just give you drugs. And one of the things this doctor was saying is like, sleep is healing for the brain. Like certain foods are healing for the brain. Our brain is everything. Some people don't even have the privilege of having limbs and a body. That some of our greatest talent in the world haven't had use of their body, only their brain. Like at the end of the day, everything is our brain, our identity, our everything, putting aside spirit and soul. I don't know if this podcast is supposed to go in this direction, but fuck it.
Yes, it is.
So to think that we like don't examine our brain ever. Like ever, like the majority of people probably never, I've never had a brain scan. Have you had a brain scan?
No, I don't think so.
Like, and that the brain is like, the brain is the goat. You know what I mean? And that we've never had, we don't have brain scans of our brain. And then we just decide that person's depressed. That person has ADHD. That person is blah, blah, blah. That, you know, you just decide. Really it is arbitrary. How can you know if you don't even have a picture of your brain? And so when I was watching this thing with this brain doctor, and he was talking to this actress who was diagnosed as bipolar, and he's like, I'm looking at your brain, you're not bipolar. He's like, you had this accident, like whatever, like years ago, and you didn't repair that part of your brain. Here's how we're gonna repair it. Like, you know, just, it's just crazy. So like I kind of, my next dream, you know how your dream is to have a podcast studio? My dream is to have a brain scan. Like, I want to have a brain scan. I want to know exactly who I am. And I want to know exactly how to be the healthiest person I can be. And I think a crucial piece of that, that I think even the sleep deprived people would agree with, or the sleep deprived champions, is that sleep is a medicine. Sleep is very healing for your muscles. You know, weightlifters will speak to this, for your mind, for so many things. So getting back to like, what don't you like about so-and-so guru? It's not that I don't like or like guru. I don't believe in leaders who promote unhealthy habits.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting talking about Gary Vee specifically, because from my vantage point, he talked a lot about hustle in 2008 to 2014 and like made that him. But like in the past, I don't know, 5 years, if you look at his content and really study it, it's like way more love focus, way more lead with your heart, do the right thing. And I think people can look at Gary Vee and say like, oh, that's just the dude about hustle. That's not a dude about love. And if you really go deep on it, you see, it's way more about happiness and love and loving yourself than it is about hustle.
Interesting. But, I don't watch his stuff anymore, but I have met him several times. And I will say, putting aside the Gary Vee on video and the Gary Vee in person, the Gary Vee in person, yo, the guy remembers absolutely everybody's name. It's wild. It's wild. He's so kind, thoughtful, passionate, energized. So as a person, I actually happen to really like him. But his message that he shares, or at least the one that I captured when I used to pay attention, was don't sleep, work, 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 don't sleep, work, work, work. And I think he really integrated that into our culture. And I think a lot of people still follow that. And as I've gone through my own journey as an entrepreneur, I found that to be disappointing, because that led me in the wrong direction.
Yeah, no, I want to talk about all that from your perspective. And this wasn't supposed to be about Gary Vee. I don't even know if we'll put this part in, but it's like, I'd love to start with you calling yourself the girl who gets it done, because that is almost like hustle and I'm going to get it done. So talk to me. Do you still subscribe to that as your moniker? And how do you feel about that today, given what we just talked about?
Right. So I was called the girl who gets it done, and then I just used it because that's what people were calling me. So that's not like self-proclaimed. I was like, oh, that sounds cool. And I think, okay, the girl who gets it done, my tagline, here's what's horrible about it. It's actually not what you said. What's horrible about it is what does it really actually mean? Like, I've always been jealous of these business people who have taglines like WordPress developer. I'm like, oh yeah, I know what you do. You're a WordPress developer. But like, what do I do? Like, what's the girl who gets it done? I don't know. Like, you know what I mean? So for you, it means hustle. For me, it means I'm very resourceful. It doesn't actually mean hustle. But like, yeah, the reason why someone called me that is, it's actually a funny story. I was with one of my higher profile friends, and they were trying to get into something and they couldn't get into it. And I made some stuff happen. And I made sure no paparazzi took photos. It was a high profile business friend of mine and like his celebrity friends. And like, and people were like, who is she? Is she the publicist? Is she the girlfriend? Like, what's her deal? Like, who is she? And people were like, she's just the girl who gets it done. Like, yep.
So what exactly did you say to people to make sure that person was just in their own lane and didn't get paparazzi or whatever? Were there any specific things you mentioned?
Well, okay. So there's so much more to the story. Like, one, the way I was able to get it done is because I think humans are like puzzle pieces where if we all fit together in the right way, we create this enormous amount of abundance together. So I literally just spoke to the right people who I'd already developed relationships with. And that's how I was able to make that happen. The second layer of that story is that I'm highly protective of people I care about. So like, I wanted my friends and his friends to have a good time. I wanted them to drink or whatever and not have to like worry about stuff. And they weren't doing anything wrong, but you know, like it's worse now, but you take a picture and you could skew it into whatever you want to skew it into. And these are like really, really like known people. So people are like defaulted, like journalists are defaulted thinking, how can I like screw them over? And I was like, do not touch these people I care about. You know what I mean? And so I was just really protective. I was looking out for cameras and all this stuff. So the second layer of the story, one, the way I was able to make it happen was via the people I knew, but they weren't extra important people. I just happened to know the security guards somewhere. Like people that, you know, sometimes people, like I don't believe in vetting people. I think it's gross. Like humans are valuable. The people who I vet, if you're an asshole, I'm allergic to you. Like I'm allergic to assholes, but if you're not an asshole, like I want to elevate you. I want to help you. I want to unify like all the good people together. Right. So like I would walk around the city. I would talk to the security guards. I would talk to whoever, just having normal conversations. Well, it just so happened my friend something, something, something. And then I was able to call these people that you wouldn't even think about. And they were like, oh, yeah, we got you, Esprit. Don't worry about it. So like the bouncer and the security guard and the owner of the club, all these random people that I was just having whatever conversations with no intention whatsoever, not knowing that I would need them at a later point. Like it turned out that it worked out. But then I guarded my friends to make sure there was like additionally like nobody that wasn't supposed to get in, got it, that kind of stuff. The reason that second layer is important is my high profile friend was like, Esprit, will you just sit with us? Will you just sit and be one of us? He didn't say it in that way, but he essentially said it in that way. And I was so obsessed with no one taking photos of them that I didn't. I stayed like the security hawk all night long. And I don't know if you could say it's a regret I have. It's in that kind of bracket. I think that that's a belief thing that sometimes like it's funny going back to like, again, the first few seconds and you're like, I want to work my way up to a podcast studio. Why? We're doing a podcast right now. You know, like why do we have these like belief systems of ourselves that we don't belong somewhere yet? You know, like here was my high profile friend essentially is like saying, look, you could be a great friend to me if you sit down right now with us and just be you. And instead I was like, no, I'm going to protect all of you. I'm less than you. I'm going to be the person that looks out for all of you, you know? And that like still bothers me today. It's not that I was protective of my friends. It's like my why, you know, that I, because like, he wanted me, like, there were so many times he's like, I want you to meet this investor. I'm like, no, no, it's okay. Like, I want you to be featured in this news article. No, no, it's okay. Because I always thought that I was like less, I mean, he was a really big deal. He's since passed away, unfortunately, but he was like a really big deal, you know? So it's like, it's just interesting how we, yeah. How we make ourselves less than.
How do you get to that place where you're looking at yourself equal to everyone?
I think that's the secret. I think everyone, well, I think maybe Elon Musk thinks he's like the most amazing thing on the planet, but I think most people don't think that they're the best and we're all experiencing imposter syndrome and just some people are better able to BS their way through it. But I think the big secret is that we're all, even the Richard Bransons of the world, like we're all trying to like figure it out. Like at every level, there's someone higher. There's something that you could have done differently. I think the people who have the secret power and this, or the superpower, and this is going to be like, I don't mean it in a negative way, but are the narcissists and the sociopaths, right? And that's probably why they say so many CEOs are sociopaths or whatever. Like these are the people that like their brain is wired to think they're the best things ever. Actually, that's not true. Narcissists are the most insecure, but then to compensate for that insecurity, they still project that they're the most secure. So the secret is the projection of security, not actually being secure on the inside. Yeah.
But we want to feel whole on the inside, right? And just feel.
Okay. So this is perfect. Okay. So this is perfect, Danny. You're like leading me down my life path. Okay. So I was like, hustler, 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 hustler. And then I was like, oh, fuck. Like, that was like not the way. And now I'm understanding that true success, and this is still something I'm working on, like really integrating into my life, but true success is inner ease. Because like we don't actually have control over the outcome. We only can do our best to have control over our own actions. And true success is inner ease. So I have so many, you know, peers that have like a million zillion people following them and this and that, and they're totally depressed, right? And you can't tell because they feel like they have to show up in this artificial way to the world on Instagram or whatever. But it's like, it's crazy. Like one of my old friends was one of the top, I'm going to stay super vague just because I'm so big on privacy, but on one of the top platforms, he was one of the top content creators on one of the top platforms. Like you couldn't get bigger than him. Right. And like, there was like cancel culture. There was a scandal that, who knows if it was right or wrong, but that was it. And then he was like wiped out overnight and has to like reinvent himself. Right. And so like, in end, even though he was at the top of the top, it was all just flexible. Like money was in and out, status is in and out. But inner ease is something like, even if something terrible happens in your life, if you're consistently in a place of inner ease, you're able to handle it. You're able to, you know, flow through the waters of life, like rather than just being knocked the F down. And yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I'm not going to talk about controversies in the media right now, but there's even people right now that I'm sure come to the top of your head, and everybody listening come to the top of their head, who were the top of their top, right? And they just recently had scandals and they've been totally knocked down off the throne. Like, this is just what happens in life, sometimes for a valid reason and sometimes just because the wrong person posted the wrong thing on the wrong day.
So I want to go back to the place where you were hustle, 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 and then came to make this realization of inner ease being the way. Yeah. What happened there?
So the thing about the inner ease is because I spent so many years in hustle mode, I now need to spend so many years training myself to be, it's hard. It's like really, 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 really hard. I experience things like when I'm really tired, what I used to do is I used to work till my eyes hurt and I physically couldn't keep my eyes open anymore. Physically, I would never take off my clothes to go to sleep. Like it was just like, I was like on some sort of like multi-year grind, you know? And now when I'm like, I'm spent, I'm tired, and I do take the time away, I feel crazy amount of guilt, like, or like I'm forgetting something, or like something's wrong, or like, you know, like I need to now train myself. It's so hard to get there. I think it was just a pathway. It wasn't like just overnight, like, oh, you have to get to, it was just going through so many painful experiences. And I think it was just like this cumulative, it's just, I get reminded of it more and more as time goes on that, oh, I had it all wrong. It's not being on the cover of Inc. magazine. It's, you know, like I was the face of Clubhouse this past year. Like, do I feel like a larger high? Like that's so cool from a vanity perspective. And it's like a moment. Also being the face of something, you deal with things that you wouldn't expect to deal with, you know, that aren't so positive sometimes, right? So there's all these like different kinds of pieces of the journey that the public doesn't necessarily see. But when you're fantasizing about being on the cover of the prominent magazine, all you fantasize about is the good parts, you know? And so arriving to think that like, okay, I think maybe it was even that Clubhouse experience that I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. like here, like I'm on the face of like this billion-dollar most prominent app and like, I don't feel full. I'm like, what's up with that? You know? And I think it forced me to like, in a hard way, like I'm still going through that journey of like, all right, what is success really? You know? And like when you have money come in and then money goes and then it comes in again and sometimes it doesn't and sometimes it's like so unpredictable for the most part.
So what were some of the most unexpected downsides of being the face of Clubhouse, because a lot of people would look at that and say, oh, there's only going to be good things that come with that. But obviously,
yeah,
there's things on your mind.
I would love to share, but I'm proactively not going to share to be respectful, because I'm really grateful for the opportunity. But
totally understand.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wish, I'm such an open person that I really would love to share. I think it would take away from the gratitude I feel for the opportunity. So in this particular moment, I'm not going to. Yeah.
Totally understand. No worries. So talk about the upsides then. Like, what, I know the message, the voice note that you left after realizing that
was the best.
Yeah. And everyone should check that out. The voice note that Esprit left when she found out that she was the face of Clubhouse. It was just a pure sense of gratitude and joy that you really got from listening to it. And I just got a smile across my face when I did, because I was so happy for your happiness in that moment. And so what has been some of the most amazing parts of that experience been like?
Honestly, like, Danny, I think that moment was the most amazing part. Like, I'm so glad I randomly captured it. Like, I mean, that was just, you know, fate, luck. That specific moment was absolutely the best part of the experience. I think there's neat parts, like when I come into a Clubhouse room, it's like, oh, the face of Clubhouse. Another really cool thing is I'm kind of part of this unspoken club of other, you know, heart-driven leaders who have also been the face, because everybody who's been the face of Clubhouse is like such, oh my gosh, dope loving humans. So to be in that little mini club of like dope loving humans is really cool. But yeah, that moment that you listened to, when I discovered that I'd be the face, that was the best part.
Okay. So when you say humans who lead with love, I think that's such an interesting phrase that you chose to use. What does that mean exactly?
Oh my gosh. So like, you know, the whole projection thing I was talking about before, I just think a lot of people project what they want to be in like a false way. Okay. Here, this is really candidly how I feel. Like, I think as a capitalistic culture, we project what we want to be as a false way in order to feed, as a culture, not me, I don't do this, but I think this is the majority of capitalism, feed into people's fears. And then people want to solve their fear so bad, and they don't believe in themselves that they could solve their own fear. So they buy into this like confidently projected message that someone else is sharing. And then that builds up that person to eventually become seemingly legitimate, but not actually legitimate. It's just because now they have a bunch of people who bought into the message. And when you have like a whole bunch of people telling a whole bunch of other people that this, you know, it becomes a thing. It's not my jam. It's not my jam. Like, I don't like in the business world words like convince. Yo, why do you need to convince somebody of something, you know? Or like, there's these words that like people, metrics, users, like scripts. Like, look, I'm all for scaling, but I'm about scaling authentically. I'm all for like templating emails, because when you need to reach out to a bunch of people, but I'm about like really think about the human being behind who you're speaking to. I was just dealing with something frustrating with PayPal, you know? And I'm like, I called PayPal probably 8 times. And the last time I got on the phone was today. And the first thing the representative got on, they're like, how can I help you? I was like, well, the very first thing that you could help me with is I just want to know that you guys care. I just want to know that you care about me. It seems like with the pandemic, all these corporations, all the studies being like, we have to have a caring campaign. Like, what? Like, why weren't you just always caring? You know what I mean? Like, all of a sudden, the marketing campaign needs to be caring. So I think that that's what the majority of business is, unfortunately. And it breaks my heart and it frustrates the world saver in me. But then these like people that have been, you know, selected to be the face of Clubhouse, what we all have in common is none of us do that. all of us genuinely, to a self-sacrificing point, care about people. Like we so genuinely care about people. It's no joke. And sometimes we may make ourselves sick over it or lose sleep over caring about someone. Or like, it's just, we so authentically in our root, it's just so cool. But is it like the fastest way to make money or to like grow a business? No, unfortunately not, which is something I struggle with. Like I was having a whole speaking Clubhouse. I was having a whole like debate about Clubhouse, about this, about longevity and kindness and like, does it really prevail? I don't know, you know, but I'm not going to change because it's who I am. Anyway, I feel like I'm talking and talking. So feel free to interrupt.
No, this is
monologue away.
please monologue away. My question to you is, how do we take someone who doesn't care about caring and have them start care about caring?
Oh my gosh. I wish. I'm writing a book right now. And this has to do with what you just asked. I'm writing a book right now. And the book is How to Build Authentic Community. And I was blocked on my book. I finished writing the first draft of the book. And then I just couldn't start writing the second draft. And I'm like, I'm part of this group called Writer's Hour. It's amazing. Writer'sHour.com. If you're looking to write a book, even a newsletter, blog, tweets, whatever. It's the coolest community. Writer's Hour is free. Anyway, I'm part of Writer's Hour, but I pay for the higher level in Writer's Hour where I get mentorship too on their Patreon or whatever. Anyway, so I have my mentor session. And I'm talking about this community leader book. And I was like, I don't know. I just feel so blocked. And what we discovered together was that I was writing the book where I thought the reader of the book had to be these people that don't genuinely care about community. And I was trying to quote unquote, like, have them care about community. And I even have a line at the beginning of my book. If you're an asshole, just give the book away. and Matt, who was mentoring me, said, I think your block is that you're writing, who you think the book is supposed to be for is not actually who you want to write the book for. And he helped guide me to understand the people I want to write the book for are people who are actually heart-driven leaders who maybe don't have guidance to know the format and steps to create a really solid community like I did in the Los Angeles tech space, right? And then when he shared that, it was like, what? Like everything opened up. But so the point of sharing all that is I don't think you can change an asshole. I think an asshole is an asshole. I mean, maybe if they go through therapy or have something horrible happen in their lives, but or maybe they're just at a maturity level that they haven't arrived at that place yet. I wish people would care about other people so bad.
Well,
and I wish companies would care about other people.
I'll tell you, I was an asshole 100%.
Wait, really? And
yes.
Because you're not now. I could see it.
And through meditation and looking deep within myself and apologizing to others and apologizing to myself, I changed completely. And found oneness and peace with all things and wanted to connect with people and things in a way that created this podcast. And it's crazy how that can actually happen. And so if I could do it, for real.
Dude, this is so inspiring. I'm so glad I'm on with you to even hear that because you could tell I lost all hope. Is it okay for you? I mean, you probably shared this on your show before, but I would love to hear more because I'm like, spiritually, like I just fell over. Like I can't believe.
Well, you know, I was sitting there at one point in March of 2020, believing like I couldn't change and like knowing all that I had done in the past. And then
did you know you were an asshole?
At some point I did. I'm not sure when it clicked for me that I actually was, probably in deep meditations.
Yeah.
But I know that meditation is the reason why it switched. Huh. And why I started to look at things way differently than I ever had before. Oh my God. It's possible. And I know because you could just look at like what I was doing in college, who I was, what type of things I was interested in.
Yeah.
And then you look at it today and people are like, this is a completely different person. What is going on here? Like, is this fake? Like,
yeah.
And even I'm thinking to myself, is this fake? And then it just happens over and over. And I know in my heart what's real.
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful thing.
I appreciate the vulnerability. And like, what led you to meditation?
My friend did it, who I respected, who I saw there was something in him that cared about people. And I wanted to be like, it was looking at someone else and seeing them.
So you knew that you didn't care about people.
At some point, but not when I started meditation. When I started meditation, it was just like, that dude, Tej Dosa, the way he speaks about certain things, it's obvious that he cares about the world. It's obvious that he cares about me. And I like how he acts. And so even though I might be an asshole, like, I want to do what he does. But not to make this all about me. And
I've talked too much. Like, this is, I'm really like, there's these moments where I feel that, like, do you ever feel like this? Like, you're communicating with the universe, like you're not actually. So I feel like that moment just now, you being like, no, I was an asshole. I feel like that was the universe, like, sending me a message, not like actually, because it really pains me, like, that people aren't kind.
Me too. Now, right?
But yeah.
There was one point in my life when I was operating completely out of ego, and it's making that shift from ego to love-based consciousness that love is based, like,
consciousness. I love that.
Yeah.
I've never heard that before.
But it's just crazy because it's possible, is my point. And like, let me be proof that it is, because
That's so cool. I'm so just grateful to have that moment with you. Like,
me too.
You totally shattered my perception just now. Not of you. I could pick up that you were a nice person. My perception of humanity. Yeah.
Yeah. It's possible. So one thing you've said before, going back to you, is you said your intuition is your oracle.
Yeah.
And so how do you develop your intuition?
Wow. First of all, I really thank you for researching me and doing your homework and caring. Like, it's super dope. So I was on the phone with my girlfriend, Holly, a long time ago, and it just came out of my mouth. I was like, oh, that's cool. And then I just kind of kept it. But where it stems from is, so I built the first action sports social network. I didn't know that that was a big deal at the time because I was just grinding, you know? And I never believed in myself. I still struggle in believing in myself. And I think that's what is my main motivator. You know how we're always looking to solve our own pains? Like, it's a huge pain of mine. So I'm always looking to, like, solve for that. Like, I love to inspire others to believe in themselves. And so my intuition is my oracle, is kind of like a love letter to that early entrepreneur saying, believe in yourself. You got this, you know, because she didn't. And I still don't, but it's still like, remember, your intuition is your oracle. You got this. Like, don't second guess. It's okay. I mean, especially like, Danny, with all these books that we read, right? Like, business is done this way and 4-hour work week that way. And like, you know, and like the productivity gurus and da, 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 da. And so you're like, okay, I got to use strides, a to-do list. And then I got to like wake up at 5 a.m. and then I got to like drink the old tech thing was drink Soylent. You know what I mean? Like, that now that's not a thing anymore, but like, it was like this constant thing. And I feel like we got to remember that, like, it's cool to create our own pathway, our own journey, and our intuition is our oracle in doing that. But it's scary. Yeah.
So what do you do when you come to a place where you don't believe in yourself and you can't see your intuition? What's the first thing you do?
I feel like this is a daily struggle. I'm proactively always working on teaching myself, well, I'm very far away from this, but teaching myself how to be my own best friend, very far away from that one. I also, I mean, Danny, there's so much, like, it's like an everyday struggle. Like, I remind myself that no matter what, I mean, I've gone through pretty awful life experiences and I've survived them all. So it's like, I remind myself, like, yo, you've gotten through like a million times worse. Like, you're good, you know? Like, I mean, it's just, there's so much. I think it's also a perception thing. Like, so this is like kind of an adjacent response. Like in the past 2 weeks, the newest lesson I've learned as an entrepreneur is when you're doing hiring, I thought, like one of the lessons I learned a long time ago was how did I contribute to the consequence if someone's not working out, right? So if someone's not working out, how did I contribute to that consequence as a leader? And I remember when my mentor told me this, I was like, what do you mean? The person, they should have known what to, how did I contribute? Like, she's like, you somehow contributed to the consequence of them not being able to get the job done, whether it was me not hiring well, me not understanding their abilities, not training well, not communicating. Somehow I took a part of responsibility in that. And so I learned that lesson at that point. So I was at this like understanding as an entrepreneur, okay, if I hire well and I understand where I'm responsible, then the job will get done, right? If I show up and do all the things. And what I learned in the last 2 weeks, it just came to me, was when you hire, you, at least in my perception, and this is kind of my intuition is my oracle, because I've never read this in a book or something. This is me being intuitive with myself, I suppose. I don't know if it's the right example, but I should quickly switch my role from hiring to observer, not assuming that the solution has been solved for yet. Because typically I would hire and think, okay, XYZ task is now solved because I just hired the right person and I'm doing all the things as a leader and I have the right training, blah, blah, blah. But no, because, okay, great. I hope it's okay to like kind of go off, but like where we all believe who we are and we're not necessarily lying about it, but we also sometimes are more aspirational than our actual competency. So if you said you can do a job and you believe you could do the job and you're not lying to me, and then I believe you that you could do the job and I need the job done, that's not necessarily a guarantee that the job's going to get done. Now I have to observe, does your competency match your aspirations? And it's my aspiration too, my aspiration of like thinking I hired so well that like the thing will be solved. So I think that was a piece I was missing, that I need to switch from hire immediately into observer. And then once it's proven like a proof of concept, then it's actually the journey starts to be solved for the thing I was hiring for. So I think something like that kind of is like your intuition is your oracle, because I've never read that in a book. Maybe it's in a book somewhere, but for me, it just came to me. I'm like, oh, maybe that's just my style of management, right? And then that would be like, maybe in that case, that's like an intuitive thing. I don't think it's the best example in the world, but it's like one soft example.
No, I like it. It makes sense to me. And it sounds like from when you first started or first learned about hiring, it was like you were placing the blame on yourself if it didn't work out.
Right.
Whereas now you're just saying, okay.
When I first started hiring, I placed the blame on them.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It was not my fault. And gotcha. Then I would place the blame on me.
Gotcha.
And now, then my second evolution was like, no, it is my fault, not theirs. But the thing that I learned in the middle was, first I'd place the blame on them. Then I realized it's not a them problem, it's a process problem. Like my processes mm-hmm. are wrong. So then I'd place the blame on me and say, okay, what's wrong in the processes? And now the next step up is, okay, it's a little bit of them, a little bit of me, a little bit of the processes, and also aspiration. So what I need to do as an astute leader is become an observer rather than stressing everybody out with my like emotional baggage of who's doing what, including toward myself and others.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's okay. Well, I'm happy you broke that down. I want
to
talk
about...
I hope
that was helpful to someone listening.
I'm sure it was. So I want to talk about moderation, because... Yeah. I think that just like how everyone is going, has become a creator in the sense of there's a camera in front of them and we are in this world of like creation and putting ourselves out there, I think a lot more people are going to become moderators than expected with Clubhouse and Twitter Spaces. So what do you know about moderating that you wish the rest of the world.
Oh my gosh. First of all, not everybody should be a moderator. They can't even be a moderator.
I know.
So I think the first thing, I'm giving you like kind of like the full version answers of everything. So let me know if I'm just talking way too much. But because the full version answer is, I think there's two pieces of that, a response to that question. There's my direct answer is, I think people need to understand it's about audience first. And I could totally go down that pathway. However, the algorithms don't care as much. So it's like, I thought the algorithms would care. I thought like the technology would want really amazing moderators. So far, I'm not convinced that really amazing moderators are going to be rewarded accordingly. I think that a lot of like, you know, just like let's take Instagram and you have like a whatever photo on Instagram that's scandalous or whatever. It gets more views, which feeds the system, which then contributes to advertising dollars. So does someone care that it's not a National Geographic photo of a bird that's like really remarkable? No, they want the scandalous thing that's going to lead to more advertising money or more, you know? So I think that there's two things going on. So I just wanted to like share that other side of it, that other element, which is unfortunately, I don't think that technology is going to foster an incredible moderating ecosystem. However, if we could get the whole world to moderate well, there's so many things that come involved. One is to be inclusive, to set format. Like for instance, in my Clubhouse rooms, I'm always like no intros, no promos. So everyone always complains that in rooms that people are promoting themselves so much, it's so easy. Just don't allow intros and promos and then you don't have that problem. You know, if you already know part of the culture dynamic of that technology, that social network is to talk about yourself for a really long time at the beginning. If you just set the format as a moderator that's not allowed in this space, then you're good, you know? So you want to think about what is the experience of the audience and what will they walk away with? How is this truly impacting their lives? And how are you creating a safe, connective space for that to happen, to cultivate that experience? What speakers do you have on? Do you have speakers? Are you paying attention to people's names? Are you pronouncing their names right? Do people feel seen and heard? Are you being inclusive? If something, and this has happened before, and it was a really hard life experience, if something happens that is uncomfortable, like somebody got upset by something, how are you going to handle it? How are you going to take ownership in that? How are you not going to put fuel on a fire, but instead, and how are you not going to run from the fire either, but instead really acknowledge everybody and like, just do the best you can to be an inclusive person, you know? So there's so many things that go into moderating well. I think it takes a lot of practice. Also the energy, how are you showing up even on this interview? And I think you are too, for, I don't know if I'm wrong. Are you standing right now?
Yes.
So am I. And that's rare, right? Why are you standing?
My energy comes across better when I'm standing.
Right.
What about you?
Right. Same. Well, I do have a story I could share later if you want to hear it, but yeah, I'm standing and it creates that energy exactly like you said, right? So think about it. When you're about to moderate, what is your energy? Do you have your water next to you? How are you showing up? Are you distracted? Are you multitasking? Do you not really want to be there? Like at the end of the day, do a gut check. How authentically do you care about the audience? Because if you don't care about them completely authentically, then just don't do it at all because you're just creating trash in the internet, you know? And so, yeah.
When you say no intros, no promos, and someone actually does do that, what is your response to it?
I cut them off and I'm like, oh, hey, heads up. I got you. But just in case you didn't hear, no intros, no promos in this room. I also make sure to proactively repeat it. And like, I'll be really mindful. Like I have a good read of people, or at least I like to think I have a good read, right? And so I'll see if somebody probably has marketer tendencies. I'll repeat it right before they speak, you know? Yeah. So they get it right away. So I'm looking at everything. I'm looking on these apps. I'm looking when someone mutes and unmutes. And then I acknowledge them because somebody may feel like they don't know when they can talk. So I'm I'm legit the guide of a useful conversation. And so you need to be extremely, or not need to be, I'd hope that you are. I am extremely attentive to like, what are the dynamics of everything going on? The mute button, the people, the topic, staying on topic, the outcome, what value are they gaining? What's happening before the moderation, like before the room? Are you pre-meeting with the speakers or not? Are you posting something? What's happening after? How are you carrying out the value? Like there's so many different elements to think about. And now that, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if I've moderated over 1,000 panels or something like that. Wow. Right. So I think it just comes with like experience and practicing, but I think at the core, like if you're an absolute new moderator, ask yourself, are you moderating for your ego or to serve? And if you're moderating for your ego, just don't. Well, I know you will anyway, because that's what people do, but just don't.
Well, isn't that a great question to ask, not just for moderating, but for anything you do? Are you doing this for ego or to serve?
Yeah.
Like that's just a perfect question to pose whenever you're starting a new activity or anything.
Yeah.
But on the topic of moderation, has there ever been a room, or what room of the 1,000+ that you've moderated, have you come away and been like, how did that happen? What is going on? Like, this is crazy. Do you have any that come out
You could share? I mean, it happens all the time. Like, okay, so this is one of those times where I wish I could just say this without a disclaimer, but I'm going to have a disclaimer where here's my little disclaimer that I need to work on. My disclaimer is I don't want to sound pompous, but I think I'm really good at like what I do. So it happens all the time. What happens is these magical connections are created. Like in yesterday's thing that I moderated, a woman had a podcast for parents who have autistic children. And then someone else had an autistic child, and then they connected. And to see those like really meaningful connections being made, I'd say one of my, there's so many. So that happens to me in almost every room. And I'm really proud of that. A particular time where I think was really just other level was I was moderating a room I created called Delivering Happiness. And it was at the height of the pandemic. And a woman had lost multiple people in her family due to COVID. And it was heartbreaking. And the whole room, I guided, this didn't just happen, I guided this to happen. We all took a moment to pray for her, in not in a religious way, just whatever that meant to us, and then to also empower her in some way. So we all went around and we empowered this one person, but the energy was so unified and it was so right and it wasn't planned. Like I, as a moderator, guided that to happen. And then this woman who was just beyond devastated in her life felt hope and connection and light in such a dark, dark, I can't even imagine, period of her life. Like that's the power of amazing moderating, is that you could do that for someone, you know?
When you say guided, you guided that to happen. What do you mean exactly?
So like if someone says something, like I'm really listening to them, I'm listening to their tone of voice, I'm listening to how they communicate, I'm like listening to the whole picture of like what's going on. And so when I say guided, like, did I say, let's take a moment for everybody who spoke? No, like I'll listen to certain things and then I'll just like tap. It's funny. I'll tap into my intuition of like, I almost feel like it's an out of body experience of how I should lead this moment. And then for me, I think I even did like a meditation or something. I don't know. I don't lead meditate. I'd never done that in my life, but like, I just pulled it out of the universe, you know, like I just, maybe the right word is guided, but also empowered that moment to happen. Like if you get a whole bunch of people in a space, whether it be virtual or in person, here's another example of guiding a moment. I was at a physical event pre-pandemic and I was a speaker. I wasn't the moderator, but because I'd moderated so much, I feel comfortable in that realm, right? And so I was a speaker and the event hadn't started yet. It was just about to start. And there were all these empty seats at the front and all these people in the back. I tapped into like, the only reason those people are in the back is not because they actually want to be in the back, is because they're embarrassed to walk up to the front. And so I stopped the event from starting, and I probably could only do this because I have so much moderator confidence or whatever. Right. And I just moderated for, and I made sure I wasn't the moderator. So I also made sure to be respectful to the moderator. And I must've said something to her in the flow of it. Like, I'm really excited for your panel or something. But like, I said to everybody in the back, we're so excited to have you here. Feel free, right now's the time that you could come up to the front. Here's how many chairs are, here's how many. And I guided that. I welcomed that opportunity to happen. So it's about how do you guide creating a really safe place to be your true self. If you want to sit in the front, if you want to sit on a chair instead of the floor, if you want to cry, if whatever that is, how do you guide that? And also, how do you know when to turn it off? Because you also have to respect that they're not the only person in the room. Like, there's 100 people, 1,000 people. So you have to like really channel in like, okay, now how do I like transition into where it's flowing next? It's really hard.
How much of that comes from your mom? Who was a speaker?
My mom, you really do your homework. My mom's the bomb. My mom is not a moderator though, but she is the most amazing speaker ever. I think possibly watching my mom on stage, it's really, do you know, out of all the interviews I've been on, you've known the most about me, and I've done a zillion interviews. So that's like crazy. Like, that's really cool. Thank you. It reminds me of like how prepared Joe Rogan is for his interviews. but like, yeah, my mom's legit the most amazing speaker ever. And I think growing up watching my mom be charismatic on stage showed me what it is to bring energy to a stage. I think when it comes to energy and that kind of thing, that's totally inspired by my mom. And I think she helped demonstrate like what it is to be a magnetic speaker. My mom doesn't get nervous, period. I feel like I want to puke the entire week before giving a talk. it doesn't feel comfortable for me until I actually start the talk, then I'm in a zone. And then right after the talk, I get really paranoid. Like, did it go okay? But moderation, I remember the first panel I moderated. I don't even know how I came to, at least I think it was the first panel I moderated. It was a really long time ago. I think maybe I had already been speaking, I believe. In my speaking career, I read the 4-hour work week and I remember thinking like, I want to be a speaker. It was, I think, something to do with reading that, anyway. So, and I remember something in the book, it's like having training ground or something, who knows? So I signed up for this educational company to teach something, to become a teacher with them so I could practice being a speaker. Like, it was my personal boot camp to practice being a speaker. So I did that for a while and I would learn how long should my speeches be? How short should they be? What should I talk about? Where are people engaged? Where do they get bored? Like, da 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 da, you know? And I think all that speaker training and maybe being a teacher, because I wasn't just speaking, I was teaching, maybe that helped. Because, you know, now that you ask me, I've never studied how to be a moderator. I feel like I've more studied how to be a speaker. Like, there's this internet marketer that I used to admire named Frank Kern. I don't know if you're familiar. And he used to give talks with it barefoot. So I was like, if he can do it, so can I, you know, like little things like that. My mom was the Mecca, but then there were little things like, oh, I could speak barefoot. Like, I could, you know, and for a while I did all my talks barefoot, you know, like, so yeah, I don't, you know, I love that question. I don't think I learned it anywhere other than experience and just practicing.
Yeah. What stuck out to me was the confidence, right? The confidence to go into a moderation room, see that a woman's dealing with a difficult situation. And I thought maybe it could be similar to the confidence of speaking in front of a stage. So I don't know if that.
No, I feel so much more confident as a moderator than I do as a speaker. Like, I don't.
Why? Well,
I don't necessarily feel like, I still get like queasy even moderating if it's like at a physical event, not necessarily like on an app, maybe a little bit. Part of it, like, okay, part of it is that I'm surprisingly introverted. So like all my extroversion is all skill set, but like when I'm not talking to you, I am like alone. Like I need to be alone a lot. And so I don't think most people realize that about me or know that about me. And so like having to tap into the extrovertedness is like kind of overwhelming all the time, you know? And so, yeah, I don't know. The thing about speaking versus moderating is I think there are really amazing speakers in this world. Not a lot, but enough. I think most moderators are awful. I think most moderators like only moderate in order to gain, to climb the social status. And most panelists only go on the panel to also stroke their ego. So I just think the world needs more people that actually care about the audience, which is why everybody's there. And what inspires me as a moderator specifically is as a young entrepreneur, I 1000% deserve to win. I'm a heart-driven person. I'm smart. I'm like, I take risks. I've sacrificed so much. That girl who started her first company, 1000% deserved to win. And she would go to panels and think that she could get like the golden nugget of knowledge so that she could win, not understanding that those people were there for themselves, not for her. And so my dedication is to her so that she always has valuable people who genuinely care about her winning because she deserves to win. So when I picture everyone in the audience, they're essentially the version of myself when I first became an entrepreneur.
And that version of yourself flew on a plane, knocked on a door, and pitched a VC without any meeting. So,
oh my God, you've really done
tell
your
that
work.
Story.
I'm like blown away, man. You're going to be famous. Yo. That is amazing. You must have spent hours like looking me up. I didn't know what a venture capitalist was. And I saw that YouTube got funded by these people called Sequoia. And I was like, well, if YouTube could do it, so can I. So I looked up Sequoia's website and they're like, you need this and that for your business card and your business plan. So I redid my business card and business plan to match their website. I messaged everybody on the website, but only the ones that I resonated with. So I'd read their bios and the ones I resonated with. And like, I would be like, hey, blah, 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 have a company, da, 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 whatever. Nobody wrote back. But there was one guy who kept like circulating in my brain. And I flew to San Francisco, borrowed my friend's car, drove to Silicon Valley, to meet with Sequoia Capital without a meeting or anything. This is just after no one even responded to an email. And I remember calling my business partner and I was like sweating and I was like, what am I doing? I'm crazy. He's like, do it for the people. Like, you know, like at his cushy 9-to-5 job, you know, as I'm like risking it all. And I go in and I'm like, hey, like to the secretary, I'm here for so-and-so. And she's like, is he expecting you? I'm like, well, I sent the email. And then he came out. And I don't even know how we got on that. I'm so like caught off guard how prepared you are. Like, but yeah, he came out and he met with me and he said, wow, essentially, thanks for being a huge risk taker. And he found my email within like a couple weeks, he set me up with a mentor to teach me what like an executive summary was and stuff like that and prepare me. And I had to pitch to 30 investors. And it's the only time in my life I legit almost passed out. I was so nervous. It was very exciting. But yeah, I don't remember what the question was.
It's okay. No, I teed you up for that story. And yeah. My follow-up to that is, what did he see in you that he wanted to just give you all these opportunities and help you in that way?
Yeah. Well, there's a few things. I think he appreciated my guts to like, and at this time there wasn't a Y Combinator. There wasn't all this stuff.
Like, what
it
year
wasn't
is this?
Like,
what year?
I don't remember anymore, but it was like, there wasn't Y Combinator because I remember hustling my way into the first Y Combinator, which was actually called Startup School before it was Y Combinator. So this was like around that time. And I think he just saw that I had a lot of courage to just show up and do that. I think there's a lot of elements that go into fundraising. One, it's who the person is. And then two, it's the sacrifices that that person's willing to make because it shows how committed they are to the thing. Because when I did raise money, I remember my investor saying like it was actually my old business partner knows this, but he said, we're going to invest in you, not in your business partner, because you've made sacrifices and we don't believe that your business partner is totally invested, which was like devastating and amazing all at the same time. But I think like that's what investors are looking for. Like, why are you the person? Not like, why is your idea smart enough? Because your idea is going to change 15,000 times. Like, and your financial forecast is full of BS, you know? So like, why are you the person in spirit and intelligence and in vigor and tenacity and perseverance that can take this company somewhere that we could 10X our investment or 100X or whatever X they're looking for?
But now it seems like you're much more in the vein of not going 100X or 10X. And it's not about scale.
Yeah. So, okay. I really appreciate that you brought that up because I flew to Google once because I wanted to sell my company to Google. And I figured, well, if I did it to me with Sequoia, I could do it again. So I flew and I researched like as deeply as you researched me, which I could tell, which I'm blown away by. I researched the engineers who built a certain product at Google that had to do with sports, and they didn't have an action sports side. They only had traditional sports. So I was like, I'm going to find these engineers and I'm going to get them to get interested in me so I could sell my company to Google. And I legit flew to Google and I knocked on all these doors. I did not find them, but they ended up calling the cops on me because I knocked on so many doors at Google and I was so scared that Google was going to turn off all my accounts, like my Gmail, my Google Drive. And I like booked it in my Nike sneakers with my Nike backpack. And I was like, oh my God, don't catch me. Like, it was wild. Why did I start saying that? Because when I was on Google that day, I was like, I don't want this level of responsibility. Like, this is gnarly. Like, two dudes are responsible for all this. I was like, no way. And I think that was the first kind of awakening that I had that, like, what kind of company do I want? I think we use that term lifestyle business and we usually associate it with bloggers or something. But what if lifestyle business literally meant just you're building your business around your lifestyle rather than it just being a blog or passive? And it's just, I don't want to be responsible for, I don't want to have that many lawsuits. And so, you know, like it's, that's just madness to me. And so I consciously want a company with like seven or less employees, because one of the things I really like, and again, this going back to kind of intuition, is I like being a really open, transparent leader. So if I'm having a bad day, I just share with my team, I'm going through a really rough time right now. But if you have a company that's like a few hundred people, you can't necessarily say, hey, I'm having a really rough time right now. So if that's the culture that I feel best in having in a company, then I'm going to have a company that's, you know, under 10 people, you know, like I think about that all the time of what is the culture that is most enjoyable to me for the lifestyle of my business and how do I build a company in that way? And then entrepreneur that I really admire is Jason Fried. And Jason Fried is all about not raising money, but just building a smart company. And he gives this example of if you don't go into a bakery and just take a cupcake because the bakery would never exist, you have to buy the cupcake for the bakery to exist. I'm like, yeah, I want a bakery where people buy the cupcakes, you know? And so I really admire Jason Fried and how he operates his business. And so my aspiration or my like dream is to continue on a path to be more like Jason Fried than to be more like the founders of Google or any of the other big companies.
Yeah, I think so much of it is that it's so easy to see Google and Facebook and these companies. They're the ones that are thrown in our face, but we don't see the bakery and the person happy with that bakery often, unless we search for them and find them as an example.
Totally.
Is that right?
Have you heard that fisherman story where like that there's a like a poor fisherman and he's really, really, really happy and a rich guy comes and the rich guy is like, oh, you could buy 15 boats and then you could turn your business into this and da 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 and I'll invest in you and da da da. And then you could have this massive empire. And the guy's like, well, then what? He's like, then you could do this and then you could sell it all off and you could spend time with your wife and be on a boat. He's like, so essentially what I'm doing right now, why would I go through all that just to like get back here?
Is that fisherman Derek Sivers, because Derek Sivers, do you know who Derek Sivers
yeah,
is?
Yeah. I don't know what Derek Sivers is doing nowadays, but he's iconic. Yeah.
He's that fisherman in the boat, just chilling, happy with who he is and what he's doing with the world. So, Esprit, this has been so much fun.
I'm blown away by you. I'm a fan. I am a fan of you now. Now, I want your autograph.
I appreciate the kind words. Is there anything?
No, you're going to be tremendously huge, right?
I just try to do as good of a job as possible with every person I speak to. And if you believe in me as much as I believe in myself, that's a great thing. I really appreciate that, truly.
I'm excited for where you're going. I'm absolutely blown away. Can I share one more thing I just learned? My newest thing.
Absolutely.
Is you were talking about, I just want everybody to have a really great experience. It's another thing I've been thinking about. How do we create phenomenal experiences for everyone from, we use this term customer experience, but what if it's not just customer? What if it's just experience? If you have a guest, what's that guest journey? What's the podcast listener journey? What's the vendor journey? For the headphone company, when you buy whatever it is, what's the journey, not just for your customers, but for everybody you interact, at least in the professional world? For example, one of my sponsors for my show, they sent me an email asking me a question. So, and because I'm always thinking about this core ethos of what's the customer experience of in the Zappos culture, delivering well, I'm like, oh, so I responded with a Loom video. I could have just been yep, we could jump on a call. I also created a meeting link called Priority Meeting, because how special would they feel seeing that they're a priority because they're paying to be a sponsor? So what are all the little details? Because we usually think about marketing or Instagram posts. No, what are all the little details that we can do that, even right now, what you're doing for me is making me feel so... it is no joke that you've done an insane amount of research. So my guest journey has now, the ultimate experience of it has been the level of research that you've done. I feel really acknowledged and seen and appreciated. How do we make everybody feel acknowledged, seen, and appreciated with everyone we interact with in our professional lives and hopefully our personal lives too, But really, and we can map it out. We could say, okay, we have a link that has this name. We do a video at this point. We do this and this and that. Whatever the little things, the little details are. But yeah.
It's a beautiful place to wrap it up. It's a beautiful sentiment to pass on. Where can people find more from you, Esprit?
Oh my gosh. So esprit@hey.com. You can email me there. Hey is owned by Jason Fried. It's Jason Fried's new company. So esprit@hey.com or anywhere on social media at Esprit Devora, ESPREEDEV, Victor ORA.
Awesome. Well, we'll have those in the show notes. Thank you, Esprit. Really appreciate you. Thank you for having me.
This is crazy. And you even have your sign in the back. Yo, impressed.
Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with Esprit Devora. You can catch new episodes of the podcast Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Thank you for listening until this moment. It means the world to me. And I'm so, so appreciative of you. If you have any thoughts or feedback about the episode, let me know on Twitter @HeyDannyMiranda. I'm looking forward to hearing from you, and I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.